Parkland High School shooting first responder and Coral Springs police trainer Scott Mitchell to talk about the shootings and gun control on this episode of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are The Uprising with Scott Cosenza and Tim Donner.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
Hey, a president. Can you believe it?
I love the poorly educated.
The voters have guaranteed themselves slavery, economic disaster.
I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
I have never met with Russians.
Our elected representatives can abuse subordinates and then secretly use a slush fund of our money to pay them off.
Black Lives Matter, the Antifa movement, is interested in preserving the fabric of America.
Today we have a very special guest on The Uprising, the podcast of LibertyNation.com, with Scott Mitchell, firearms and tactics trainer, Coral Springs Police Department. Now, Coral Springs is a neighboring jurisdiction to Parkland, Florida, where the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School massacre happened, and he was on scene in response to the killings. Welcome, Scott, to The Uprising.
Hey, good to talk to you.
So I'll say at the outset for everybody that you're not here as a spokesman for your department, and that opinions that you give are yours alone. So with that off the table, let me ask you, just describe your job generally and your police experience for people, please.
Yeah, so I started in police work about 19, give or take, years ago in Maryland. I was a sheriff's deputy there for a little better than a year. And after that, I moved to South Florida and took a job as a police officer with the Coral Springs Police Department. And I've been there for a little better than 17, almost 18 years now.
And as a trainer, is this something you do as part of your policing duties? Like, are you in a car, you know, responding to calls, or is that just your whole position?
Yeah, so about 5 years ago, I moved into the training division as a firearms and tactics trainer there. So most of my duties are centered around training officers with their firearms and with their tasers and, you know, with their other weapons. We do a lot of tactical training, and then I maintain a lot of that equipment also.
Okay, well,
that's my primary duties. I don't work on the street anymore. I did that for the first 12 years or so, give or take.
Okay, well, I want to get back to some of those topics about training and firearms in a minute, but first, if you could, tell us, on Valentine's Day last week, what did you see? You know, what was your experience with the shooting?
Yeah, so I actually was off duty when it happened. I had spent the previous 2 days down at the police academy in the south end of the county, and I had left the academy a little bit earlier than I had anticipated that I would. So it was about 2:15 or so. I had left the academy, and I was preparing to call it a day. It was Valentine's Day, and I was tired. You know, I was going to get home to the wife, and we had dinner plans, and I was driving my police car, and I was listening to the, you know, to the radio, talk radio or something, and I noticed I'm out on the major highway that's running north and south through the county, and I'm just about to exit the highway heading home, and I see two police cars from my police department. Again, I'm not in my city at this point, and I see these two police cars driving with their lights and siren on towards my city. And followed shortly thereafter by a couple of police cars from other jurisdictions. And so, you know, when you see police cars,
you realize all hell's broken loose at that point, I'm guessing, right?
Yeah, it looks like they're heading towards my city, and that everybody's going. That's what I'm seeing. So at that point, you know, I turn my police radio up so I can hear the transmissions. And the first transmission that I hear is, we have five bodies in the first, I don't remember, room. I don't recall, but it was about five bodies, and, you know, then you know that something terrible has happened, and I initiated my response to the school.
And what did your response consist of?
So, I turned on the lights and siren, and I started to go, and at that point, I didn't really know, you know, exactly where or even really exactly what. I knew it was some sort of casualty event. So, you know, the information started to come in. I actually didn't even know what school it was at till pretty late in my arrival. And I was following those lights and sirens that I had seen go by me. I said, well, I'll stick with the group. And, you know, because the transmissions that I'm getting that are coming in, you know, they're not explaining where this is. These are tactical transmissions from inside the building. So I'm just trying to piece together information the best I can. And I sort of follow the group. And then there was another officer, and I don't remember the jurisdiction, that was right in front of me with his lights on, and he was the guy I was following at this point. And we pulled off of the highway onto the surface streets into that Coral Springs, Parkland area, and he got out of his car and went to his trunk. And I knew, you know, this is normal for anyone that's not wearing body armor. That's probably where it is. And, of course, that's what he was doing, was retrieving his body armor and a rifle. And so I did exactly the same thing. And when I got out of the car, he yelled back to me, "It's at Stoneman Douglas. It's at Stoneman Douglas." So fortunately, he said that to me. And so we went there together, you know, him sort of leading the way.
Mm-hmm. Is it typical for police officers to have, in South Florida at least anyway, to have rifles in their trunks?
Yeah, I would say that it's more typical than not. Some of the larger departments don't buy them, but the officers in those places can buy them themselves. Most of the smaller agencies that I work with, they do buy them. My police department buys them for everyone.
Okay, and if we just can return briefly to what happened on the 14th, it's fair to say that you didn't see any firefight or the shooter himself on that day. Is that right?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, my arrival, and I'm not really sure about the timeline, but I'm guessing I was probably about 20 minutes or so into the problem by the time I arrived. It might have been 25 minutes, I don't know. But when I got there, there was already elements from our police department in the building actively clearing the building. And the thing that struck me when I arrived was just the sheer volume of police cars and now fire trucks and ambulances that were arriving. And, you know, 20 minutes is a long time in the modern social media age. And so our police department has an active Facebook page where they push out information as quickly as they can. So now parents are starting to see it from there and from their kids inside the building who are texting and calling.
Mm-hmm.
Parents are now fully aware that there's a problem. So the entire area is flooded with their vehicles and mm-hmm. them actually standing on the roads and on the sidewalks. So it was just a massive confusion.
Okay, can you tell me, how are school shooting scenarios or possibilities addressed with current, and I think probably safe to say just with Coral Springs Police Department training? You are a police trainer. What do your officers go through in terms of these scenarios?
Is it okay to answer this to give you just some context to kind of where we began and sort of where we are now?
Yeah, of course.
So,
you know, you've been a police officer. You know, when was Columbine? You were a cop when Columbine happened. I imagine the landscape has changed considerably since then.
Right, and that kind of works as a, you know, defining moment sort of in modern law enforcement response to these things. And so, you know, we have two periods of time, pre-Columbine, post-Columbine, and leading up to Columbine, the normal tactics would have been for the initial responding officer or officers to respond and seal off the problem, sort of build a perimeter around it, get information to operations, command, whatever, and wait for specialized units to arrive, which is usually a SWAT team. So that is what happened at Columbine, and you know, that sort of tactic takes a long time. And these events typically don't last very long, so you're waiting for these teams to arrive. Meanwhile, the carnage is happening, and by the time the teams arrive, it's all over. There's nothing that they can do.
Mm-hmm.
So we have evolved over the years to change that, and really it's a factor of time to speed up our timeline. And some years ago, we started to do sort of a cell movement, a quad movement, where you still wouldn't enter immediately. You'd arrive and you would wait until you had an element of, you know, 3 to 5 officers, hopefully armed with carbines, and then you would move in these sort of, you know, sort of predetermined configurations, these elements to go in. And it was quicker than the previous tactic of just sitting there, but it was still too slow. And one of the things that we learned in, you know, gaming this over and over, is that as soon as someone starts to shoot at you, these formations just, you know, they break up. They really were not that effective.
Mm-hmm.
So as time went on and we had more of these instances occur around the country, what we figured out was, you know, we really have to go faster even than that. We got to speed it up. And so where we've arrived now, at least from the law enforcement side, is you enter now with what you have right away. And, you know, the theory is, especially on situations like this one, you're bringing 100% more into this than there is already there. The theory is you've got a weapon, maybe two, body armor, and more importantly, training and the will to engage this person. So that's where we are now in the Coral Springs Police, and it has become nationwide sort of the standard now. And they call it all kinds of things, solo officer response, immediate response. There's a lot of different words for it, but the idea is you don't wait. You go now, take what you can, let's get the job done.
Okay, well, this is, you know, there are, Scott Peterson is the name of the school resource officer that was stationed at the school, who has now resigned and, according to Fox News, is being slammed as a coward by Trump. I presume that was in a tweet. I haven't read that. And I don't want to get into asking you to necessarily criticize a brother officer from a neighboring jurisdiction, no less. But it's fair to say that he wasn't trained probably to wait. Or is it possible that because he was a police officer for so long, that was his training?
He certainly was a police officer long enough to have been trained to create a perimeter and wait for SWAT. But I know the trainers at the Broward Sheriff's Office, and I have attended sessions that they've done for active shooter, and they have not trained officers to stand back and wait
mm-hmm.
any time in the last, it has to be since 2008 at least that I'm aware of, because I've seen it since then. So
right.
It probably was even before that.
Let's say I was a cop and I came on the job in 1995, I haven't gone through basic training or initiation training since then. Are my updates, would this kind of a new technique in how to respond to this this threat be covered in an annual update or ongoing training, or how typically is that addressed by departments?
Yeah, so typically what you've got is an in-service training requirement that has to go on every year. And there is mandates that come down from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, in this case for us, and then there's other things that the agencies will add to it. And active shooter, as far as I know, has been included in every in-service from every police department in Broward County. I can't speak beyond that, but I know I'm very, very, I have a very tight communication network within Broward County with the police trainers. We meet every so often. I personally am friends with Broward County trainers and former trainers. And like I said, I have attended their training, and I know what those guys have been taught in their in-service training, their annual training, it is a regular update that you would receive. Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell us, is this something that goes department by department? Like, is it possible that there are, you know, departments it's just convenient, I think, probably to stick with Florida because that's where your expertise is and that's where you're a sworn officer. Are there departments in Florida that may not be teaching this kind of a thing? Is it outliers? Is it at a state level? Everybody agrees, hey, this is the new, you know, clearly we see the results of this type of training are effective or not, and let's adjust, you know, in accordance with those facts, or how does that all work?
Yeah, there are standards and recommendations that come out from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, which include tactics like this. I know that the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, FLETC, is teaching these classes, and they have an entire manual and recommendation for that. So, you know, insofar as that, you know, there are these, you know, authorities in what is normal police practices, yeah, they have established this as the way to go. Now, whether you've got an outlier department of three officers that doesn't train very well or very often, I suppose that's possible, yeah.
Okay. So let's say there was something that you learned from this event that you think should be that you think makes the current training either obsolete or insufficient in some regard. How would you go about bringing that change to the table? In other words, is this something that you have to do at the state level? Could you do it with your own police brass or political authorities? You know, if you saw some, you know, again, just some aspect, and I'm not thinking of anything in particular. I'm just trying to get a sense of how this, you know, how these the training is adapted to the facts on the ground going forward.
Yeah, so what I can speak for is within my own department. We're about 215 sworn officers, and we're fortunate in my department. We're given all the resources and equipment we need, and they give the training unit complete authority to shape what is taught. Now, you know, everything that is taught goes through a review from the administration, but in my 5 or 6 years in the training unit, I've never seen any resistance to anything that we brought to the table. Yeah, if there was something that we identify as lacking or we need to do or this has got to change, the administration has always been very receptive, and they, you know, they put us in these positions for a reason. They take a look at it and they say, okay, let's get it done, do what you need to do. So I've never seen any resistance to it. So in my case, if there was a deficiency, I would bring it to the attention of my commanders, probably would write something up for them to review, and then just start the process of logistically getting it done.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's maybe switch gears a little bit, and can you tell me, I know that you're not, you know, an investigating officer for this shooting case, so I'm not presuming that you are in asking this question, but there's been this discussion of the killer, Mr. Cruz, and whether or not he could have been removed into custody under Florida's Baker Act. Can you give us just a thumbnail sketch of what the Baker Act is, please?
Yeah, so the Baker Act, for as far as law enforcement is concerned, it's a law that allows, or actually requires, police officers to take into custody for an involuntary examination someone who is exhibiting signs of possible mental illness, along with some criteria that essentially allows the officer to come to a reasonable conclusion that without intervention, this person poses a risk, you know, to themselves or to other folks, or just, you know, neglecting themselves or causing injury to themselves or someone else.
Okay. Have you Baker acted someone in your capacity as a police officer?
I have.
And can you describe the experience of what that's like? I mean, is it just you get a call and you find a person who is, you know, for lack of a better word, a crazy person, and you take them into custody? Is it as simple as that?
Usually, I would say if I had to kind of provide like sort of a sketch of the average Baker Act that I was ever involved in, it would be somebody who had told either, you know, a family member or a friend or even police dispatch that they wanted to kill themselves. Mm-hmm. And I would go out there and I would, you know, talk to the person. And if the person either said, yeah, I'm going to do it, or say, for example, may have cut their wrists, you know, relatively recently. I'm not looking for scars from, you know, 2 years ago, but right, there's, you know, fresh wounds on their wrists from them cutting themselves. Then, you know, that would be kind of a normal situation.
And so yeah, Let's say you do find somebody like that, and you make the decision that you're going to go ahead and have them involuntarily, you know, committed or seen to because of the Baker Act. What's the process like? You cuff them, you put them in your car, you take them to a mental hospital. What happens?
Yeah, so we would take them to a receiving facility, and for that was one of two hospitals, and typically they'd be handcuffed, they'd be put into, you know, a police vehicle,
right,
or an ambulance if they needed that, and they would be taken to one of our receiving facilities, which again was one of our hospitals in the area, essentially just taking them into the emergency room, and they would be greeted there by hospital staff and hospital security.
And you don't, I'm assuming, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you don't then return to, for instance, their residence and search for firearms, do you?
Never.
Okay. So if I'm at my house and I attempt suicide and my roommate calls the police and you arrive and you commit me via the Baker Act, I'm just trying to get to like this, I guess my, and I know that, you know, again, I don't want to put you in a sticky wicket with issue, you know, commenting on a case that is still open in the state where you're a cop. But if this guy was Baker acted, okay, if he was taken into custody, is it true that he may have been evaluated and released and then still been able to commit this massacre because the Baker Act is sort of a short-term Band-Aid for somebody? Or is that a misreading of the landscape?
I think that's accurate. I think, you know, because the Baker Act is a 72-hour deal. And as I understand it, there's no connection between having been Baker acted or any of the evaluation that may have gone on or any of the report from the doctor or anything like that that's connected to this system in which, you know, you'd be run through for the background check when buying a gun.
Okay. All right. Well, let's switch gears again now. I want to talk about a couple of the sort of responses and what do you think about training teachers to carry? You think that's a good idea, a bad idea? Any thoughts?
Let me interrupt and say
necessarily, it's not necessarily just teachers, school staff that are non-police officers in any case, carrying guns on campus.
Yeah, you know, I don't know, that, you know, my perspective on it isn't so much like, you know, training teachers to carry. I think more it would be, you know, allowing teachers that would ordinarily carry in every other facet of normal American life in your community to allow them to continue to do it when they go to work.
So just remove the prohibition then rather than institute a new plan or something like that.
Right. And yet as soon as that conversation comes up, a lot of teachers object, well, I don't want to be armed. And it's not those folks that I'm even talking about.
Right.
It's folks that would ordinarily be armed anyway.
Right, right. I'm sure there's plenty of, I'm trying to remember how many states we now have with, you know, shall issue states. It's probably over 30, well into the 30s, if not 40. So lots of people in their daily lives choose to carry, and that would be the case here. That would just happen to be, they wouldn't be forced to disarm, I guess, in that sense. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would say too, if you know, whether you know this is important or not, but I, you know, if the decisions for this sort of thing were more localized, I guess. I mean, we've got a number of high schools and middle schools and such in my jurisdiction. If the decisions about this stuff, I think, were more localized, and, you know, because everybody's going to want things like training and oversight of this sort of thing. I mean, at least in my situation in our town, you know, the trainers doing what I do, we'd be perfectly happy to facilitate it.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be glad to do it.
Is there a concern that with an incident like this, like a school shooting, that a teacher could be mistaken for the shooter? Or, you know, is there any training given to law enforcement to not treat everyone with a gun as a you know, as somebody they should, you know, who's not wearing a police uniform to shoot them? Is that overblown, or is that how do you deal with that?
Well, we do. I mean, because we have to work and live in this environment all the time in Florida, where you know, just regular folks, law-abiding folks, have guns, and so you know, part of the training that our guys and gals go through is, you know, target discrimination and understanding what is and what is not a threat, and we actually do go into some fairly detailed discussions about concealed carry. And if you go into one of these events, I mean, obviously when you go into a school at this point, it's very unlikely you're going to come across somebody else with a gun. But if you have a mass incident like this in a shopping mall, you know, it's highly likely in Florida that you're going to come across concealed weapon holders. And so, you know, it's kind of a two-way street. The concealed weapon holder has got to be ready to make law enforcement, you know, aware of who he is and what his intentions are.
Mm-hmm.
And just like it's the job of the police officer to understand that there will likely be people there that are just trying to help that happen to have a gun.
Okay. Are there, you're a parent, and I know that for most parents, especially parents of school-age children, when they see an incident like this on the news, of course, they are terrified that they will someday see an incident like that on the news with at their child's school. Do you have any specific safety instructions that you either would give to your own children or that you would recommend other people give, or any kind of specific, like, hey, if you're involved in an incident like this, do A, B, and C?
Do you mean within a school?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. You know, I've got a niece that's older, a teenager, and, you know, and a lot of this is sort of dependent on where you are when this happens. But I think the advice that I would give, if it's an older child, obviously a small child this doesn't work for, but if it's an older child and the option exists for the child to get away from the problem, just to run, that would probably be one of my biggest pieces of advice. If I have a teenage child that's capable of handling themselves away from adults,
right.
I'm not going to... you know, it's not like you're going to be able to leave a locked classroom particularly easy, but if you're in the hallway, you're in the gym, you're in the cafeteria, you're walking between buildings, you're on the football field, just run away from the damn thing. Mm-hmm. Don't try to hunker down.
Yeah, this shelter-in-place, lockdown instructions seem to, I'm not a studied police instructor or in tactics or anything else, so this is just my own sense of things, but why wouldn't you run? In other words, is there any sense that this lockdown and all the schools around me, it seems like based on the news reports that I digest, not based on any academic study I've done, favor this lockdown type of thing where there's any kind of incident, you know, even like 5 miles away, there's a whatever. Oh, everything's locked down, which I actually have some problems with on the false imprisonment side of things as an attorney. But is that
I think the.
Go ahead.
So I think the idea with the lockdown thing is the idea is kind of like a, almost like a ship that might be about to sink. You're trying to compartmentalize things. And if there's some damage out there, then you're sealing this area off here. At least that's what it seems to be doing. They're trying to prevent movement from one area to another so that the damage can be sealed off. You know, and in the case of this school, you know, if you were, you know, seated in the classroom on the third floor of the building, you know, and there's a shooter on the second floor, you know, obviously running, probably a bad idea.
Mm-hmm. You know? Okay. All right. Well, moving forward from the incident, there has been, of course, an ocean of effort to try to move the ball in a way to restrict gun sales in various ways and move policy in certain directions. I want to ask you, based on your 20 years of experience in law enforcement and your firearms training experience and all your expertise, are there any gun control laws that are not on the books now that you think, and I don't want to use the word easy, like it's a cure-all, but that would relatively quickly, you know, move to fix the problem that we have with these school massacres that would make a significant difference?
I just don't think that the problem has anything to do with the gun. And so, no, I don't think that the, you know, adding more laws would help. I don't think anything's missing. Because I don't think that's the problem.
You know, the problem is Mr. Cruz and the future Mr. Cruz's, I guess. All right. Anything that I've left out that you think that, you know, would help inform people to understand what's going on or what they could do to act differently, to save their own lives or the lives of others in something?
Yeah.
Like
you know,
this?
A couple of things I would say, you know, both mostly from my own experience, even in this case, you know, if you're going to, first of all, you need to have some sort of a plan, whether it's, you know, you're in the school or you're in a, you know, in a shopping mall, but you need to have some sort of a plan in case this happens. You know, what might you do? Where are you going to go? You know certain things. There are certain things people don't even know or don't think about. Say, for example, in a typical shopping mall, every single one of those stores in a shopping mall has got a door in the back that goes into a service corridor. Most people don't think that. They have to run towards the main exits of a mall. Small things like that. If you have equipment that you are carrying on you, whether it's a firearm or, you know, bleeding control equipment, tourniquets and stuff like that, some folks like to carry this stuff, that's great, but it's got to be ready, and it has to be on you. And you're not going to be able to process. Your brain is not going to be able to function at a high enough level to piece all this gear together at that moment. So it's got to be ready.
Okay, Scott, I know that you are also, add to your other list of duties and accomplishments, you are a police drone pilot. And can you tell me how drones specifically or technology generally plays into the mix here as sort of a closeout question? I know that there's been some controversy about a 20-minute delay in viewing video on scene, and I don't need you to get into the weeds on that, but just the landscape, what are drones doing here, and what are other technological advancements that we might see that are interesting that we may not have heard about?
Yeah, I think some of the confusion with the drones on the part, and a lot of that has to do with the police not doing a good job of sort of explaining it, but some of the confusion with the drones is, you know, it goes along with some of the Fourth Amendment stuff. The thing is with the drone use, especially at least under my experience in my police department, you know, we're not using it to we're not spying on people. It's not something. It's not an eye in the sky that's up there. In the case of this incident, you know, sending the aircraft up to look at a window, or in this case, a bank of windows, because we do know that there was some effort to actually shoot out of a window. And this is basically what this is a high definition camera that can be parked, you know, outside of an objective and feed live data down to an incident commander. And so the ability to sort of take an extremely high-definition camera and put it anywhere that a SWAT commander might want to look at in an active incident like this is obviously going to provide, you know, sort of real-world intelligence right now as to what's happening that before now was never even possible. And then, of course, after the incident is over, all of that video is recorded, and so you've got evidentiary discoverable video that, you know, anybody can go back to and learn from or refer to. And the other thing I think is important about, you know, the current situation with drones is you can do this at a very low cost and a very low or actually non-existent risk to human life to put them there.
So helicopter pilots call your office then, it sounds like. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for running towards the fire from me and everyone else who depends on good guys with a gun to stop a bad guy with a gun.
Great. Thanks for having me on. It's a real pleasure to talk to you, Scott.
That's it for this episode of The Uprising, the podcast of LibertyNation.com. Thank you for joining us.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising with Scott Cosenza and Tim Donner.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
Hey, a president. Can you believe it?
I love the poorly educated.
The voters have guaranteed themselves slavery, economic disaster.
I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
I have never met with Russians.
Our elected representatives can abuse subordinates and then secretly use a slush fund of our money to pay them off.
Black Lives Matter, the Antifa movement, are interested in preserving the fabric of America.